From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are Katherine Gibson, VOA Congressional Correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA Executive Producer. Welcome, Katherine and Steve.
Good to be here.
Same here. Glad to be with you.
Well, here are the issues. Progressives in the Democratic Party are scrambling to save top priorities that risk being scaled down or cut from President Biden's social spending plan as Democratic leadership and the White House race to get a deal. Among some of the top issues Democrats say that they are still ironing out are climate change provisions and a tax targeting billionaires. The passage of the spending bill could affect a vital race for governor in Virginia that remains close in the final stretch of a campaign between Democrat Terry McAuliffe and Republican Glenn Youngkin. Both are tied at roughly 45% each. President Biden announced a $100 million initiative meant to improve the U.S. relationship with the Organization of Southeast Asian Nations. This comes as Biden is looking to strengthen the U.S. presence in the Pacific in the face of China's growth as a national security and economic adversary. After the military takeover of the government in Sudan, Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with Sudanese Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who was released from custody earlier in the week. The U.S. is calling for a return to the civilian-led transition to democracy. Concerns over the COVID-19 pandemic and vaccine inequity topped the agenda as G20 leaders met in person in Rome. Their hope was to vaccinate 40% of the population of each country by the end of this year. With a little more than 2 months to go, it does not appear that that goal will be met. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Katherine, I'll start with you. Some of the top issues the Democrats are trying to work out in President Biden's social spending package include a tax targeting billionaires. Will this billionaire's tax survive, and who would benefit from it?
Well, the question really is, what of anything will survive in this massive spending package that started out initially with a $3 trillion price tag? And of course, that final number has been up for negotiation over these past few months as President Biden is really getting more involved in the negotiations, taking more of an active role in bringing members of Congress to the White House to hammer out exactly what will be in that deal. And we know that that tax on billionaires is an important part of the bill because it would help pay for all of these human services, these social services that Democrats are trying to pass. This is an ambitious piece of legislation. It's one of the biggest pieces of social spending that's really been proposed in the past few decades. And when we think about that, we also have to remember that Democrats are trying to pass it with the narrowest of margins in the U.S. Congress. They need every single Democratic senator on board with this. And that's why it's frankly been taking so long to hammer out. This is something that's being called the human infrastructure package, which is being paired with the actual physical infrastructure package that is hopefully going to be passed by Democrats in the next few coming days. All of this is tied together, and it's been very difficult for Democrats to hammer that out.
And it's happening at a time where the economy of the United States is experiencing some inflationary measures as a lot of government money that has been injected into the economy throughout the COVID pandemic is being used, and prices are going up because supply chains have been broken and still aren't repaired. So all of this spending is now becoming a political issue. And Democrats, especially centrist Democrats, are seeing the inflation numbers rise and are not in any mood to add to that. And so there's this friction within the Democratic Party between these centrists versus the progressives who want to move ahead with a larger social safety net. So the politics of this whole thing is coming into more of a view a year out from next year's, the 2022 congressional elections, in which Democrats are fearful that their very small majorities that Katherine mentioned will be lost, because usually the election after a president is elected, that president's party usually loses seats in Congress. So the Democrats are very fearful that they're going to lose seats in Congress. This is their only chance to be able to put into place these social safety net programs that they've been trying to do for the last 20, 30 years. And it is one of the toughest slogs as far as getting legislation passed that I can remember in the 30, 40 years that I've been here in Washington covering the United States government.
Right. Well, part of that is because of the way the Biden administration has strategized this. They've kind of thrown all of these programs into one massive bill, a reconciliation bill, which is basically a mechanism for passing all of this in one go. And in a way, they've complicated things for themselves by putting everything under that huge umbrella instead of passing legislation bit by bit. And it's also complicated how the Biden administration is messaging that to the American people. There's no, you know, shorthand way of referring to this bill. You've heard it just in the way we've been talking about it. It's the reconciliation bill, the $3 trillion bill, the social safety net bill. That's going to complicate selling it to the American people and reminding them at midterm time, hey, the Democrats passed this legislation for you, reminding them that this is something that the Biden administration has achieved. That's a real stumbling block for the White House.
That's a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up about the messaging to the American people, because it doesn't seem like they did a really good job with getting the message out, with communicating with Americans about the bill and various aspects of it.
Yeah, Democrats put it out there at the very beginning as a $3.5 trillion measure that is down from $6 trillion. And so the legislation has been defined by its cost rather than what is in it. And most of that is because Democrats really never took the opportunity and made the time to really try to explain all of the things that are going into this bill for the American people to digest.
That said, if Biden can hammer out a deal in Congress and they have that moment where everybody comes out and after months and months of negotiations, they can announce an agreement, then you maybe will get a moment that the Biden administration can sell to the American people when they have that final checklist, which is something we don't have right now, where they say, look, we're funding childcare, we're funding climate initiatives, we're funding all of these different social safety net programs, and this is what it will do for the American people. But of course, we don't have that moment yet because we still don't have an agreement after months and months of back and forth.
And that is because the Democrats only have a very slim margin of error, slim margins in both houses of Congress, and they just don't have the votes yet to be able to put it out there. They are counting on the year between whenever this thing gets passed and the next election to be able to make those explanations that Catherine pointed out to the American people. And they hope that the squabbling of the past 6 months will be lost in the year-long move and the year-long campaign to the next election.
Very good points that you all brought up with this. And also, you mentioned, Steve, with the midterms more than a year away, most of the forces that will shape next year's congressional elections are already in play in Virginia. The governor's race between former Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe and Republican nominee Glenn Youngkin is a closely watched statewide race with national implications. So why is this an important race for Americans who do not live in Virginia?
You know, Virginia, they do their governor's race 1 year after the presidential election. So it's an off-year election. There's only one other state that elects a governor in this off-year where there isn't a whole lot of attention on national attention on politics. But what the parties have historically done is they've tested out themes for the next election on Virginia, because Virginia had been a relatively Republican state up until, you know, the last 10 years or so, where it became much more Democratic. President Biden beat former President Trump in Virginia in 2020 by 10 percentage points, which I've watched Virginia politics for 40 years, and that kind of blew me away that the Democrats were able to mount that kind of a vote against Republicans. So what McAuliffe, Terry McAuliffe, the former governor of Virginia, is trying to get another term. He's been trying to tie Republican candidate Glenn Youngkin to Trump through campaign ads, and as well as having former President Obama, First Lady Jill Biden, and President Biden coming out to Virginia to campaign for him. All of them have been trying to tie the Republican candidate Glenn Youngkin to President Trump. Youngkin has been trying to portray McAuliffe as out of touch on social issues about education and what's being taught in Virginia schools, crime rates. So what we're seeing in Virginia is all of these different political themes and political strategies that will be deployed nationwide. Virginia is the testing ground for all of it and has historically been the testing ground for all of these strategies in this governor's race.
Yes, very good point. And also, Catherine, while Steve did mention that former President Trump was front and center as part of this Virginia gubernatorial race, also President Biden, former President Obama, and Georgia House Representative Stacey Abrams stumped for McAuliffe, as Steve pointed out. So have they really inspired voters? Where does former President Trump fit into this race?
Well, I think it's important to look at the demographics of Virginia. As Steve mentioned, this is a state that has really changed in the past few decades from a reliable Republican white Southern stronghold to something much more diverse. And that's in large part because of the suburbs in Virginia that are part of the larger Washington, D.C. capital area. That's a very diverse area. And it means that the African-American vote is a key part of this race. The African-American votes have played, you know, a really important part in pushing Democrats over the finish line in these Virginia races, in presidential races, and in gubernatorial races. And having Stacey Abrams, having former President Obama, having those campaigners come for McAuliffe is playing a key part in getting that African-American vote out. As you mentioned, over on the other side, Youngkin has walked a fine line in terms of President Trump. You know, of course, he does have that endorsement from the former president, but he's also tried to paint himself as something of a suburban moderate, worried about jobs, worried about schools, not getting into those, you know, social issues or contentious issues that President Trump might be associated with. So he's trying to reach out to Republican voters on all sides of the spectrum. And it'll be interesting to see how that approach plays in terms of whether or not President Trump has influence headed into the 2022 midterms.
One thing to remember is that the Virginia governor's race has been a political bellwether of sorts. There's just been one time in the last 50 years that the political party who holds the White House wins the Virginia governor's race. It's only happened once in 50 years that that historical precedent has been upended. And that was in 2013, and that was by Terry McAuliffe. He ran for governor in 2013 after Barack Obama won the White House, and he won. The Democrats were able to hold on to the Virginia governor's race. And McAuliffe is running again. So he may be the only one in 50 years, depending on the outcome of the November 2nd election. If he wins, he'll be the only one who will have done it twice. And it will say something larger about the national race that's going to come in 2022 and in 2024 if McAuliffe can win this race.
Thanks, both of you, for breaking this very interesting governor's race in Virginia, for breaking this down for us. And looking on to President Biden's hopes of strengthening ties with Southeast Asian countries in the face of China's growth as a national security and economic adversary, there was a virtual summit, which was a little overshadowed by other U.S. news taking the limelight. But how essential are these Southeast Asian nations to the U.S., Catherine?
Well, that's something that the U.S. has been trying to build over the past few decades, particularly during the Obama administration as well. And of course, we saw that deal earlier this year with Australia, where the U.S. is going to be selling submarine technology. We know that that, of course, caused a little bit of a diplomatic tiff with France, one of our solid European allies. But when we step back, we know that this is a very important alliance that the U.S. is wanting to build in order to counter Chinese influence in the region. And it's something that is closely watched up on Capitol Hill. I can say that as well.
This is the first time the U.S. president has participated in an ASEAN summit since 2017. President Trump, when he was in office, had a relationship with China that focused entirely on China and somewhat left these nations, the ASEAN nations, it's a 10-nation association, kind of adrift and wondering whether the United States would be the security guarantor for those nations against China's regional ambitions. President Biden's $100 million initiative is going to fund health, climate, economic, educational programs in the alliance. But there's still concern that these nations, Indonesia being the largest of them as far as population, they're concerned that China is going to creep and hold much more power, much more authority, and be the kind of country in that region that really sucks up a lot of the energy and creates concern among all of these countries that China will do something to either interfere or encroach upon their own sovereignty. So they really look to the United States as being that security guarantor. And President Biden has made it a point to show these countries a little bit more love than they have gotten in the past.
Yes, and we will continue to follow developments as President Biden continues to try to strengthen relationships with Southeast Asian nations. Time now for a quick break, and when we come back, the U.S. is calling for Sudan to return to the civilian-led transition to democracy. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panelists who are joining me via Skype, Katherine Gibson, VOA Congressional Correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA Executive Producer. Katherine, there was immediate international condemnation on the military takeover of Sudan. For instance, the World Bank halted disbursements for operations in Sudan in response to the military's seizure of power from a transitional government, while state oil company workers, doctors, and pilots joined civilian groups opposing the takeover. What is the reaction that you have seen on Capitol Hill over the takeover?
Right. So there's been an immediate reaction on Capitol Hill in regards to this problem in the Sudan, where there's been a conflict between the military and the transitional government. U.S. senators passed a package earlier this year that was intended to help the transitional government. There's nearly $1 billion in assistance. The U.S. was looking at debt relief for the Sudan, as well as taking the country off the list of state-sponsored terror. And they were really looking for a way to support the country. And a group of bipartisan senators immediately called out this week and said that the U.S. needed to follow the situation closely. And that includes Democratic Senator Chris Coons, who some viewers may know as a close friend and ally of President Biden in the U.S. Congress. He goes to the Sudan quite regularly and will be following this situation. He called for the two sides to really come to an agreement with each other and stop this violence and to protect those pro-democracy protesters. This is something the U.S. and the U.S. Congress will be following closely.
The coup comes about 2 years after basically another coup that ousted the longtime dictator of Sudan, Omar al-Bashir, who is right now in jail and facing genocide charges in the world court. So he was pushed out of power by the military and by massive protests out on the street. The military forged a transitional government with civilian leaders. Elections have been promised but never held, and now the military is ruining all of that and has taken over. Right now at risk, about $700 million of direct economic aid for Sudan that the State Department says was intended to, as Catherine mentioned, to support the country's transition to democracy. So right now it's somewhat of a face-off as most of the world is condemning what has happened in Sudan. The UN Secretary General condemned it. Most countries in the world have condemned it. And Egypt is now seen as a real player in trying to move this process forward and defuse the situation.
Sudan's General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, the head of Sudan's military, is said to have framed his takeover as a push towards stability and progress. He also said that elections will be held in 2023. However, critics are very skeptical of this pledge, and this is the international community looking at this. What really can we expect from Sudan's military at this point?
That's a really good question. The situation is still fluid. Sudan has never had much of a democracy foundation, so it does look like this is somewhat of a stalemate until some sort of negotiations are put forward and some nation is able to work with the Sudanese military in seeking some sort of resolution to the situation.
So we will continue to follow this issue as well. And on now to our final topic. President Biden met with G20 leaders in Rome to tackle a number of topics, but we have time to really just focus on one, and one that topped their agenda was the inequity in vaccine distributions around the world, with health advocates saying rich countries are not doing enough to protect poorer countries from COVID-19 and its variants. Catherine, is this a valid argument?
You need to place it into context and see that the U.S. has led in donations in terms of vaccines. We've donated more than 200 billion vaccines around the world, but we have lagged in terms of the infrastructure of getting those vaccines out. They're still not getting enough to the world. And there's been some arguments that, you know, here in the U.S., we have people who have already gotten through their first and second doses of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And some people here in the U.S. are already getting their six-month booster shots. Well, there are people in the world who haven't even gotten their first or second shots. So there are still issues and problems to be ironed out. And there are problems in terms of having people just take the vaccine. You know, these G20 nations had aimed, as you mentioned, for that 40% vaccination rate by the end of the year. And it's pretty clear right now that that benchmark will absolutely not be reached. And that's a huge problem because no matter how the vaccination rates reach here in the United States, you still need everyone globally to be vaccinated and protected against this virus.
UNICEF has pointed out this vaccine disparity. The G20 countries receive 15 times the COVID vaccine doses per capita than the sub-Saharan African countries. I work on another VOA show, and we did a show on COVID, and there are countries with 88% and 85% vaccination rates, as well as countries that have less than 1% of vaccination rates. And this disparity has got to be figured out in order for the entire world to move beyond the pandemic and get back to what will be a new normal.
Has anything else come out in terms of other types of commitments?
Don't know about what commitments are being made. UNICEF is saying that the COVAX effort, this worldwide vaccine donation effort that has been organized, has fallen considerably short of the promised 1.3 billion doses. UNICEF says only about 360 million of the promised 1.3 billion have shown up. So there's a huge gap between what has been promised as far as donations by various different countries and what has actually been donated as far as doses are concerned.
Well, we'll have to close the show on that note. My thanks to our panelists, Catherine Gibson, VOA Congressional Correspondent, and Steve Reddish, VOA Executive Producer. I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for joining us for Issues in the News.